we know this. This was a really good and experienced crew.
A search continues for six fishermen missing in the Bering Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 13th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a proposal to implement a new statewide income tax is drawing mixed reviews from lawmakers.
This is complex. If I'm asking questions, you can understand what the public's going to ask on this.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
2 days after a fishing vessel went missing in the Bering Sea, U.S. Coast Guard officials say there's been no sign of the ship or the six people on board since searchers found its emergency beacon on Saturday afternoon. The fishing vessel destination sent a distress signal Saturday morning, 2 miles northwest of St. George Island. The Coast Guard launched an air search for the 98-foot crabber, which is based in Sandpoint and Seattle. A man named David Wilson and his brother have owned the boat for more than 30 years.
They are a long-time Alaska fishing family with deep roots in the Sandpoint community.
Michael Barcott is a maritime attorney representing the destination's owners. He says the vessel was on its way to fish for Opelio snow crab when it activated its electronic position indicating radio beacon or EPIRB.
It had left Sandpoint, called in Dutch to pick up some bait, and it was on its way to St. Paul Island. The EPIRB went off at 6:11 in the morning, Saturday morning, and it appears that it was somewhere between 2 and 4 miles off St. George Island at the time.
The Coast Guard has not released any theories as to what may have happened to the destination. Barcott says the owners don't know either.
We know this. This was a really good and experienced crew. The captain and the crew were professionals. This captain had been on this boat for a long time. The boat was in good condition, and it is an absolute mystery what happened.
Coast Guard Petty Officer Lauren Stenson says searchers found the boat's emergency beacon at sea Saturday afternoon among a debris field containing buoys, a life ring, and an oil sheen. Stenson says it's unclear how long the Coast Guard will continue looking. She says the Coast Guard cutter Morgenthau is still searching, along with an HC-130 air crew. Meanwhile, St. George residents are watching the shoreline for signs of the vessel or its six missing crew members. In a separate incident, three people were rescued this morning after their fishing vessel ran aground near Acutan Harbor. After the U.S. Coast Guard heard reports the FV Predator was taking on water, Petty Officer John Paul Rios says the agency launched a rescue by air. Rios says the Predator ran aground hard, and it's unclear whether it can be repaired.
There was a 8-inch crack in the hull of the vessel. That's what was causing it to take on water. I haven't been notified anything about pollution or anything like that. That's something that we'll definitely still keep an eye on.
All of the crew members are reported to be in good physical condition. Under a proposed statewide income tax in the capital, Alaskans would have a choice when they apply for their annual permanent fund dividend, whether or not to set aside money to pay for their next year's state income tax liability. Employers could deduct state income tax payments from workers' paychecks, but if workers prefer to pay with PFDs, they could ask their employers to deduct less money each pay period. Alaskans who pay income taxes to other states would receive a credit to reduce their Alaska taxes. Some Minority Caucus Republicans expressed displeasure with the bill's details in a Senate Finance Committee meeting today. North Pole Representative Tammy Wilson told a Department of Revenue official it will be difficult for spouses who file their federal tax return jointly but who pay state income taxes in different states.
First of all, what you just said is a nightmare. I've done that with states before. And when you're trying to figure out who to credit whom, it's luckily they have H&R Block online.
There could be two main new taxes passed this year. The income tax would be 15% of federal liability. A couple with two children and $150,000 in gross income would pay about $20,000 in federal income tax after deductions and $3,000 in state taxes. A separate 10% tax would be applied on all capital gains, such as the sale of stocks and bonds. Anchorage Democrat Representative Les Guerra says residents should be clear that the income tax rate under the bill isn't applied on their overall income.
15% of a 25% federal tax is a 3.75% tax. I just don't want anybody walking around saying this bill is imposing a 15% tax when it's not.
Anchorage Republican Representative Lance Pruitt expressed concern about the complexity of the bill. The legislation would also draw money from the permanent fund to pay for part of the state government budget.
This is complex. If I'm asking questions, you can understand what the public's going to ask on this.
Bill supporters say it would bring stability to the state's budget and economy. The House Finance Committee will hold more hearings on the bill this week. The Trump administration's federal hiring freeze is creating uncertainty for Alaska's national parks. A January 31st announcement that seasonal employees may be exempt from the order eased some of the stress on parks, but there are still questions about the future. KHNS's Emily Files has more on Alaska's most visited national park.
And Skagway in 1898 was a pretty rough place. Sam Steele of the Northwest Mounted Police called it one of the roughest places on earth.
Charlotte Henson led a group of cruise ship visitors on a tour of historic sites in Skagway last summer. Henson is one of about 30 seasonal staff who work for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. They help serve the extreme influx of visitors Skagway sees each summer from cruise ships. Whether federal agencies like the Park Service could fill seasonal and permanent jobs was thrown into limbo when President Donald Trump took office in January. Ben Hayes is chief of interpretation for the Klondike Park. He read a prepared statement and referred other questions to the offices overseeing the seasonal exemptions.
The National Park Service is consulting with the Office of Personnel Management and Office of Management and Budget on their guidance for implementing the hiring freeze. As with previous hiring freezes, the National Park Service will work with the administration to ensure that we meet the needs of park visitors across the system.
Meeting the needs of park visitors to Skagway requires a robust staff of park rangers and other employees. The town of less than 1,000 year-round residents has close to 1 million cruise ship visitors between May and September, and the historic Chilkoot Trail sees more than 10,000 hikers each year. The Park Service will have to clear its seasonal hiring plans with the Federal Office of Management and Budget. KHNS contacted the Office of Personnel Management, the Park Service, and the Department of Interior to learn how long it might take to approve seasonal hiring plans. None responded by deadline for this report. Reed McCluskey is a retired Park Service employee. He oversaw hiring for the Klondike Park for about 7 years, and before that served as chief ranger.
When you're looking at the rapidly approaching summer season for Skagway, you've got to be offering jobs right now. And all the employers feel the same way. They need to offer jobs. Employees need to make commitments. And yet the Park Service and at Klondike Gold Rush, they're really not able to do that right now.
Even if the park is able to fill its about 30 seasonal positions, hiring permanent staff is still on hold. And when the freeze ends, there could be permanent reductions. The Trump administration directed the Office of Management and Budget to create a long-term plan to reduce the size of the federal government's workforce through attrition. Once that plan is in place, the hiring freeze order will expire. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, watching from afar, how scientists monitor Alaska's remote volcanoes.
The volcanoes are kind of like babies. They never come at a convenient time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
22 candidates have filed to run for the Anchorage Assembly in the upcoming April election. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the vote could have major implications for the body and its relationship with the mayor's administration.
The Assembly is technically nonpartisan, no Democrat or Republican affiliations, but members' individual politics can shape whether the 11-person body tilts right or left, and right now it leans liberal. But six spots are up for election, more than half the total seats, and because of term limits, four of those races are totally open. If neither of the two candidates hangs on to their position, a majority of members will be new once they're sworn into office. The Assembly's ideological persuasion has major implications for both local and state politics, yet turnout in municipal elections tends to be extremely low. Last year, it was barely over 20% in Anchorage. The current Assembly has had a smooth relationship with the Liberal Berkowitz administration, a dynamic that could get rockier if several conservative candidates win seats. Issues that have come before the Assembly in recent years include property and sales taxes, the city's equal rights ordinance, capital projects, public safety programs, and the annual operating budget. There's a seat up for a vote in every city district, from Chugiak to Girdwood. There's also two area-wide school board seats up for a vote. The election is April 4th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Over the past 25 years, Alaska's legislature has passed nearly a dozen resolutions asking Congress to allow drilling in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more on why this largely ceremonial action is taking on new meaning this year.
When Donetta Tritt talks about her hometown of Arctic Village, she talks about caribou.
So when I was little, I didn't know that caribou was called caribou. I called it meat. And so I'd be like, look, Mom, meat. Like a caribou running on the mountain or something. I'd be like, meat.
Arctic Village sits on the edge of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in the Brooks Range. Just 152 people lived there in 2010. Tritt, who lives in Fairbanks now, flew to Juneau to represent her Nitsai Gwich'in people and talk about the importance of the porcupine caribou herd. She's protesting a resolution that's become somewhat of a habit for the legislature to pass, a call on Congress to open up the refuge, or ANWR, to drilling. The Arctic coastal plain of ANWR is an important calving and birthing ground for the porcupine herd, and Tritt says that drilling in the refuge could have serious ramifications for the lives of people in Arctic Village and the Gwich'in as a whole. But not everyone in her district feels that way. The Kotzebue Democrat who introduced the resolution, Representative Dean Westlake, is chairman of the House's Arctic Committee. His district covers the North Slope and includes the refuge. And he doesn't dispute that the environmental concerns of some of his constituents are important. But he says his district desperately needs an economic boost. And he's looking toward an industry that has provided that boost to the North Slope and surrounding villages for decades.
I, when I was a young man, I worked on the North Slope like a lot of young people did to get money to go pursue a dream. The money's there.
Westlake says he depends on the land for food and honors the environment, but he believes that responsible development is key to the health of the region. These are not new arguments for and against opening the refuge to drilling. They're arguments that have played out in legislative hearings for decades at the state level, though not usually at this scale. Princess Johnson from Fairbanks has been following these resolutions for a long time, but this year she decided to visit Juneau in person.
Typically, this is a resolution that gets passed every year in our state legislature, and we don't normally. There's a testimony that happens, and I've shown up before, and it's been a handful of people, a couple of people that are for that, a couple of people that are speaking out against it, and we know that it's just always standard.
Johnson says the political environment has become extreme in the last year, and it's motivated her and activists like her to be louder about their concerns. This is the first time she's traveled to Juneau to talk to legislators. She's used to skipping state politics altogether and going straight to Washington, D.C. to get an audience with federal politicians. The state's resolution, while largely ceremonial, could also carry more weight this year with the state's delegation in D.C. Alaska's U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan introduced a bill in January to open up a portion of the refuge for drilling. And on the House side, Representative Don Young introduced a similar bill. And with the new presidential administration and a Republican-led Congress, these bills may have a better chance at gaining traction. And it's an uphill battle for Tritt, Johnson, and dozens of people who testified before the two statehouse committees that have heard the resolution so far. Both committees heard an overwhelming amount of testimony against the resolution and then quickly passed it through. And even lawmakers who say they support environmental arguments against opening ANWR won't vote against it. Here's Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson.
The folks, particularly in this room, who've testified about their concerns, I don't view them as wrong. I just don't view them as wrong. They have a long view, and I have real concerns that that long view is shortening. That is, I'm worried about my planet, and they make some very good arguments. And they're among the finest Alaskans I've met. Having said that, my state needs revenue.
And with arguments like that, it's likely that the resolution will continue its path to sail smoothly through the legislature for the 12th time. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
Across Alaska, there are monitoring instruments on 31 of the most active volcanoes, but there's nothing on the one that's erupting now. Bogoslaw Volcano is on a tiny uninhabited island in the middle of the Bering Sea. With eruptions spraying ash up to 35,000 feet, the Federal Aviation Administration has banned flights from flying over it. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports on how scientists keep tabs on a restless volcano from afar.
Since mid-December, Bogoslaw has erupted more than two dozen times.
Typically, they've happened sort of late at night. The volcanoes are kind of like babies. They never come at a convenient time.
That's Dave Schneider, a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage. He says unpredictable and frequent eruptions have kept scientists up around the clock doing status checks. But the technology has gotten to the point where the crew can do most monitoring from anywhere, including their homes. And the team can act quickly when the need arises. Last year, Pavlov, one of Alaska's most active volcanoes, had a surprise eruption that caught Schneider at the Easter dinner table.
You know, you kind of move aside the ham and you open up your laptop and you take a look at what's going on. And that's just what we do.
But watching Bogoslaw is more tricky than Pavlov due to its remoteness and lack of on-island monitoring network. Bogoslaw belongs to a rare class of submarine volcanoes that have erupted through the ocean's surface. There are only a handful around the world, which means researchers at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, or AVO, are looking for clues in the history of a similar Icelandic volcano. Schneider says there aren't really any options for monitors on Bogoslaw because the island is so small.
It'd be difficult to actually put much of a monitoring network on it, and even if there were seismic instruments there, they likely would have been destroyed by eruptive activity at this point.
The decision on where the AVO places equipment, Schneider says, is based on how much threat a volcano poses to nearby people and property. And there's all sorts of different tools the organization can use to monitor volcanic activity, from seismic instruments to satellites to infrasound data. In the case of Bogoslaw, they're not in the business of predicting eruptions. Schneider has worked in Alaska for two decades and says Bogoslaw's eruption is unlike anything he's seen in the state.
We don't have any other experience with this type of eruption style with a vent through the ocean, during my time period in Alaska. The previous eruption of Bogoslaw was in 1992, and there were no nearby seismometers like we have now that would allow us to do this kind of analysis that we're currently conducting.
So the ongoing explosions and seismic activity at Bogoslaw are writing the history books for what eruptions at this volcano look like. But the distant monitoring instruments on Umnak Island and in Sand Point are only picking up the largest seismic events. Chris Way Thomas is a geologist for USGS. While he's glad there's a network to support monitoring of Bogoslaw 24 years after its last eruption, he doesn't think it's enough.
I think we're still missing a fair bit of the story. I think there's a lot more going on out there than we're not catching. So that's a little frustrating.
One thing the team missed was the date of the first eruption back in December. AVO first noticed the eruption on December 20th after a pilot reported an ash plume. But looking back at the seismic record, they now believe activity began more than a week earlier. Wei Thomas says watching the eruption progress is interesting, but he's more interested for what comes next.
What we're doing now is, you know, the real-time volcano monitoring and preliminary interpretation of the data streams. A lot of the story remains to be told.
Wei Thomas says hundreds of papers can be written after eruptions like this one. He's hoping once the volcano cools off and Bogusław Island is safe, he'll be able to check it out for himself. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Last summer, Ketchikan Indian Community began a phytoplankton and shellfish monitoring program as part of the Southeast Alaska Tribal Toxins Program. KIC tests samples and informs the public if dangerous levels of the toxin that causes paralytic shellfish poisoning are found in local clams and mussels. KRBD's Maria Dudzak has this report.
Nicole Forbes is the environmental specialist at KIC in charge of collecting samples. She says it's important for people to understand what paralytic shellfish poisoning is and how it is transmitted.
Basically, there's tiny little microscopic plants in the ocean, and they're called phytoplankton. And most of them are not harmful. In fact, they produce 50% of our oxygen. But there's a few harmful species, and one of those is Alexandrium, and it produces something called saxitoxin. And when the shellfish filter feed, it gets collected in the shellfish, and when people eat it, that's what causes paralytic shellfish poisoning.
PSP toxins cannot be cooked or cleaned out of shellfish, and freezing does not destroy the toxin. Consumption of the toxin can cause paralysis and death. Commercial shellfish is tested and considered safe. The Tribal Toxins Program targets recreational beaches.
We're trying to figure out where most people harvest so that we can get those results, because the thing is, you have to get results for each beach, because you could go 2 or 3 miles down and it's going to be completely different down there.
Forbes says there are 3 steps to the collection process, which starts with weekly phytoplankton samples.
Which involves me going out there with a phytoplankton net and wading in the water and grabbing a sample, and I bring that back to our local lab.
Forbes says suspect samples are sent to the Sitka Tribe of Alaska's lab in Sitka. She says the turnaround time for testing is fairly quick.
I send it out on Tuesday, gets there Wednesday, I get results Thursday or Friday.
She says the 3rd step of the process is filtration, which involves taking a water sample, filtering it, and then sending the filter to the lab, where phytoplankton species and quantities are identified, along with concentration of toxins. Tony Gallegos, the Cultural and Natural Resources Director for KIC, says Alexandrium may be present, but not necessarily producing toxins.
Scientific literature hasn't really come to, a clear conclusion on how you know whether they're going to produce the toxins or not. What triggers that? That's still unclear. So really, we can see the algae, but really we need to actually do an analysis of that algae to see if they actually have toxins in them.
Forbes says phytoplankton aren't as active in the winter because it's cold and dark, but she says no time of the year is safe to harvest without testing. She says they found high levels of toxins in butter clams at Whipple Creek this winter.
Actually, butter clams hold on to the toxins longer, and then during the winter, the shellfish slow down their filter feeding, so they can actually hold on to those toxins for the whole winter.
Forbes says she collects samples every 2 weeks, weather permitting, and if samples test positive, they are retested weekly. Results for all Southeast beaches being tested are posted in the data section of the Southeast Alaska Tribal Association research website, www.ctor.org. Information is also sent to local media. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
2015 Yukon Quest winner Brent Sass scratched on Sunday afternoon just 16 miles from the central checkpoint because of concerns over the health of two of his dogs. Meanwhile, extreme cold and fatigue took their toll on the remaining teams. The 75-mile run from Circle to Central, which typically takes lead teams 10 hours, stretched to 16 or more on Sunday.
It's just made for a very slow trek.
Quest leader Matt Hall of Two Rivers traveled about 5 miles an hour up Birch Creek toward Central yesterday. Hall said the slow pace was largely because of drag created by the abrasive snow, but also other factors.
It's really slow. Well, part of it is we're going to be slowing down at this point in time in the race anyway. We ran kind of hard, so it makes double sense we'd be slowing down. And then even though it's very, very faint, the entire 80 miles here is uphill. It's going up a drainage.
Hall had a big lead over second-place musher Hugh Neff at Central last night. Hall made the run over Eagle Summit early this morning as the temperatures began warming. Alan Moore, now running third, has been picking up speed after struggling with sick dogs.
They haven't been feeling too parky up to now, but they're coming around, I hope, right now.
Moore says his dogs have remained hungry through the illness.
One feeding, I figured it up, it was almost 30 pounds of dog food. 12 dogs.
Moore, Ed Hopkins, and Paige Drobny camped in Central Monday morning, resting for the big climb over Eagle Summit and on to Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Emily Files in Haines, Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Molly Reddick in Fairbanks, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel February 15th and 16th at the AVCP Housing Authority Conference Room from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.